This morning, we have Joe Graham with us. He's on staff with Harbor Churches. He's the multi-state director. Joe's a friend of mine, and we actually got to, the first time I went to Puerto Rico, I went with Joe. We went together and got to experience that. So that was really meaningful, and he's going to be with us here to close our Lesser Gods series this morning. So I will invite you to welcome Joe with us.
Does it work? We got a brand new cord on the mic. Right. Nice and clear, and then like this will probably fall off during the teaching. So I'm gonna grab this. How y'all doing today? You good? Well, it's so good to be with you all. My name is Joe Graham, one of the pastors of Harbor Churches, as Wally said. I get to live in the space of sharing our mission, helping people find their way back to God. And so that means different things depending on the day, depending on the week. And what that means today is I get to be at one of my favorite Harbor Churches, Walker Harbor. So it's good to be with you all. And yes, Wally and I went to Puerto Rico together, and it was spectacular. So I think I've heard rumors of a trip. Taking some more folks, I highly recommend it. It will change you, and you will have a new place in the world that you love and get to be a part of. So this morning, we're going to finish the sermon series, Lesser Gods, because who doesn't like to talk about idols? The things that we love more than we love God, right? Well, most of us would rather take those deep loves that we have and the shame and guilt and pain that we have through them and go behind the doors. With this series, we've tried to come out and name what some of they are, what things we sacrifice and put before the thing that we care about most. Should we serve the lesser gods, right? The stuff that we have, the self inside of us. The self-worship. Are we willing to sacrifice things? You know, sometimes we make sacrifices because we think it will lead to something better. We sacrifice time and money so we can send our family and our kids to the best schools and the best places. We sacrifice our sleep and our health to keep working so we can work harder and get the raise, get the promotion. And we wonder, when we do those things, is it really worth it? So we've wrestled with the idol of self and the idol of instant gratification, and today we're going to wrestle with the idol of comfort. And this isn't the idol of stuff. It's not the comforts that we get from all the different things we can try to possess. This is the idol of avoidance. It's the idol of not engaging with what makes us uncomfortable. So you may have heard it said, a message within you and around us, pursue what's easy and comfortable, and seek what feels good. But what if there was a different way? What if there was a way that was right and just and holy, and that was to pursue ways that are a little more uncomfortable? And maybe the way to the good life is through a way of discomfort. Maybe the way of Jesus and the way of kingdom of God is looking at the idol of comfort and going, I'm going to lean into what makes me uncomfortable. Was thinking, I don't remember, the no pain, no gain t-shirt. You remember that, right? No pain, no gain. Well, the idol of comfort essentially rejects that notion. It rejects that things should be hard. So yeah, we're gonna talk about conflict a little bit today. Whenever you get invited to guest speak somewhere and they invite you to talk about conflict, you go, what don't I know about what's happening? So we can move the chairs, we're going to have a restorative circle, we're going to affirm what everyone is saying, and, you know, it'll be great. I'm going to come back for leftover Thanksgiving, because that sounds like a restorative circle. Because who's excited to go to Thanksgiving and deal with discomfort and pain and family systems and stories, right? Right? So next Sunday, Walker Harbor Church's restorative circle, all right? So the verses that are shaping this entire series, I'm not sure if you shared them in the previous week, but I'm going to put it up for us. It's from James chapter 1, verses 13 and 15. When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. Then, after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. One of the ahas for me in this sermon series has been looking at all these different heroes of the Bible and realizing they were the ones who made vows with God. Like, a lot of those vows were their idea. And God is actually generous, but when you make these vows with God, they become idols, and then they deceive you, and then it leads to sin, and sin leads to death, and idols pull us away from the abundant life that Jesus calls us towards. Jesus says, I am life, and I have life to the full, and that is a thing of abundance and generosity. And idols pull us away from a life of abundance because they operate in a mindset of scarcity. And when you live in scarcity, you focus on the way of death. And Jesus says, I have a new message, and my way is a way of life, life to the full. So to enter this idea of the idol of avoidance and the idol of comfort, we're going to live into a family story. One of the families of the Bible, that Jacob and Esau, they're two twin brothers. And so we're going to do a little storytelling this morning, kind of a paraphrase of this incredible story about a family that has so many crazy things happen that I think all of us in all of our crazy stories might just have something in common, right? And why not? Because we're entering that time of the year, this season of gratitude, where we are very thankful for everything, and we're thankful by spending time with our brother-in-law, right? As Wally mentioned. So I'm going to sit down and do a little story time. And as I was thinking about how to get into this story and what is that feeling of, like, How do you say the uncomfortable thing? How do you respond to it? I was drawn into my own family story, some holiday gathering where, you know, you get the guest bedroom for your entire family, right? So then someone's sleeping on the floor in a whoop-de-doo bed, as we call it in our family. And I remember trying to wrestle my son, who was about five, down to the floor for bed. And literally, we're going to bed on the floor, and I'm going to sleep next to him on the floor because, you know, these family gatherings. Does anybody have this experience where you travel, see family, like, hey, you've got the guest room. All right, we got three kids. Anyways, we're laying down to go to sleep, and my son looks at me and goes, why do you have two moms and two dads? He was old enough to do the math, right? See, my folks got divorced, and they're now remarried. That's part of my story. And he was old enough to ask the question, why do you have two moms and two dads? All the things, right? All the things. And I go, I'll tell you on the drive home tomorrow, right? And so that's what we did on the drive home, is we talked about what divorce was and why you have six grandparents, right? And so that's part of my story. And then I remember, to put some humor on the story, I walk out and talk to my brother. I'm like, Baxter just asked me this. He goes, Joe, my oldest son is adopted. We covered all that stuff really soon. I don't know if you've noticed. So, you know, there's always the lightheartedness to it. But it's like those stories are all very real, and they make us human. So today we're going to talk about a story of twin brothers. So once upon a time, there were twin brothers, and they were twins, and they were brothers. The oldest was named Esau, and the youngest was named Jacob. Esau was the apple of his father's eye because he was a wild man, a hunter who could track and kill all kinds of game. He was a hairy man of the wilderness. This is how they describe him. He was a man's man, draped in camo, driving a lifted Silverado with a 10-point whitetail in the box. And I literally went to get gas and saw, I think it's called a dually, right? Silverado. And he was at the diesel pump. I only know it's the diesel pump because I've tried to fill up my Civic at it, and it's not me. So he was the hunter. So if you're wondering who Wally and I are in the story, we're not Esau. All right? So then there was Jacob, a slightly younger brother. We call him the mama's boy sometime. She loved him, taught him how to cook, all right? And she also taught him how to trick his father and brother into giving him whatever he wanted. From birth, these two have a rivalry, Esau and Jacob. Now, back then, the thing a young man wanted most in the world was the blessing of his father, also called the birthright, because with the birthright came the inheritance, flocks and herds and tents and servants and wealth. And traditionally, the birthright blessing always belonged to the oldest son, and in this case, it was Esau. In Genesis 25, it reads this, because this is when the story gets tough. Once, when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country famished. He said to Jacob, "Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished." Jacob replied, "First, sell me your birthright. Trade me your candy." "Look, I'm about to die," Esau said. Apparently, he had been out on a wild hunt. "What good is the birthright to me?" But Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank and then got up and left. We talked about the idol of instant gratification. And here it is on display. Esau is hungry and he gives away his birthright. He loses his mind. He's controlled by his compulsion. He is a slave to his urges. So Esau got up, drank, and left, and promptly forgot about the promise he had made in the moment. But Jacob didn't forget, and neither did his mother. Years later, the boy's father, Isaac, the same Isaac who is the son of Abraham, the same Abraham who took Isaac to the top of a mountain and was moments away from sacrificing his son until God stopped him, which gives us some grace for their dad. Maybe Isaac isn't such a great parent because he had to walk that journey, right? Anyway, Isaac is about to die, and he asks his favorite son, Esau, to hunt some wild game for him and to prepare a final meal. Esau leaves, and Jacob and his mother conspire to trick Isaac into giving the blessing to Jacob. They prepare a meal, and they dress Jacob up like his brother, and their deceit and trickery works. Isaac mistakenly blesses Jacob, thinking that it is Esau. So last week, we talked about the idol of self, continually putting your own desires and needs above the desires of needs in others, living as though you are the center of the universe. Call that self-worship or narcissism. Jacob and his mother are guilty of worshiping the idol of self, sacrificing their integrity for personal gain. And do we even know why they do this? It echoes what we read earlier in James, right? Each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. It's like they don't even know why they're doing this. And the next thing they know, they've ripped the family apart. Moments later, Esau comes back with the meal that he has prepared and found for his father so that he can receive the blessing and birthright. And it's a terrible scene. Esau weeps and begs his father, saying, "Bless me too, father. Don't you have anything left for me?" But it's like he already signed the inheritance away. He's like, "I can't undo what I just did." And in that moment, Esau makes a vow and holds a grudge. Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. He said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." Any echoes of Cain and Abel, the first brothers of the Bible, right? Sibling rivalry is brutal. And does it make you wonder, are we doomed ourselves to repeat these cycles? Like from the beginning, have we not as the human race been repeating these cycles of rivalry and discomfort? Tragic storylines over and over and over again. Are we caught in an infinite loop of self-imposed catastrophe? Consider this. Jacob, the son who wasn't his dad's favorite, ends up having 12 sons of his own. So Jacob, who inherently knows the pain of being overlooked, who does he pick as his favorite son? Joseph, right? So he repeats the sin of his father in his own kids. There are endless cycles of self-inflicted pain. If you look at your own life and your own family story, you might see the same thing. You might see some dysfunction, maybe worse than this. But regardless of this, I think we all face some kind of generational sin. Like there's something in us. There's these, and some of these things are these idols that we put before God. And sometimes it seems as if our own kids are doomed to relive these tragic storylines unless we stop the cycles. And stopping the cycles takes courage. It takes growth. It takes self-awareness, because you have to die to yourself when we live in a society and culture that says you should celebrate yourself. Back to the twin brothers. This story of deception and vengeance sets the stage for years of conflict between the boys as Jacob runs from Esau, afraid that he will make good on his promise to kill him. Jacob flees, and he meets lots of other people along the way. I invite you to go through your Bible this week, Genesis 25 to 35, and just get a piece of paper and notice all the different things that happen. It is wild. And so Jacob goes on his own way, and he does really well. So he has he receives great material blessing. He gets more money, more herds. One of the weird things about the Bible I read, he married his uncle's daughter, and I did the math in my head. Yep, that's his cousin. Actually married two of his cousins, right? It's a time and place that we don't understand a lot different. One of those, like, you read the Bible again, and you're like, that's his cousin. And then someone else, like, actually married both of his cousins because he married, and he has two wives, right? There's that whole thing, too. So context, 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 as Wally Harrison famously says. So we can ask Wally to help us understand all those things another time, all right? So, whew, Bible is crazy. All right. But if you go through that, you see there's these family dynamics, which actually invites us into the story. We've got father wounds. Money and wealth. Any tension around money and family wealth in our families? Broken marriages, infertility, judgment over spousal selection, marrying someone who's out of the tribe, not, you know, like, are we going to send our kids to Christian school or not? Right? Yeah. Anyways, I'm not from West Michigan, so I'm comfortable talking about that. So moving away, lies, tricks, more money, grudges, rivalry, earning parents' approval, affection. It goes on and on and on and on. And sometimes, though, like the Bible, we think it's so different, but it's actually not that different. And yet here's the beautiful part of it. God continues to use us as he continued to use those people. Like, he still chooses us in spite of it all. See, it's crazy. So then years later, the day Jacob fears most finally happens. Jacob and Esau are about to meet again. Esau is on his way, and he's coming with 400 men. Jacob believes that Esau is going to make good on his promise to take his life. And so he tries to buy favor with Esau. He sends a gift. If you're wondering what kind of gift to get someone to make amends, here's what you should do. 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 female camels and their young, 40 cows and 10 bulls, and 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. Genesis 32, 14 and 15. So if you're trying to make amends, just send that herd, all right? It's like the ancient version of sending flowers and a gift card. So then Jacob does what most of us do after he sends the gift, when we think we're in serious trouble. He tries to bargain with God. He tries to make one of these vows that we've looked like that the people of the Bible tend to do. They make a vow with God. They try to make this thing that they can't keep. He actually sends his family ahead to the other side of a river, and he sits alone by himself, hoping that his plan will work, hoping that the gift and the parade in front of him will change Esau's mind. And that night, a mysterious man shows up, and they wrestle all night, which is a whole nother sermon, maybe 4, 5, or 6. And it turns out in the morning that Jacob was wrestling a representative of God. He was wrestling an angel. And after wrestling all night, that angel gives him a new name, and his new name is Israel. Does that sound familiar? Is that a popular word in the Bible? Is that an important one? You see, Jacob, his name means the one behind or the one who overreaches. Literally, it's like a heel grabber, meaning that they were twins, and as they were coming out, the baby was grabbing the heel of Esau, Jacob. And so he has been a deceiver his entire life. And then he has this experience. He has a dark night of the soul where he literally encounters an angel, and after wrestling with that angel and probably wrestling with himself, that angel gives him a new name. And he gets to decide if he's going to continue in his old ways, because in that moment, in his pain, in his bargain with God, God actually still chooses him. God gives him a new name and says, you can grow, you can change. You can stop this self-inflicted cycle of catastrophe if he's willing to be a man who will have courage and self-awareness and to wrestle with the difficult things. See, when we talk about the idol of comfort, we see that Jacob has this idol because he was willing to do anything to avoid that which might be difficult. He literally put the women and children between him and his brother who was coming with 400 men. But when he meets God in his moment of pain, he is forced into discomfort. He faces the challenge. He actually wrestles. I think that's why there's so many sermons here. Like, he wrestles with God, right? He perseveres in the fight. The angel actually, he says, I won't let you stop wrestling me unless you give me a blessing. So he embraces this discomfort. He actually has the moxie to go through what is difficult. But he also walks away with a limp. So he gets a new name and he gets the blessing of an angel. And he walks away with a limp. Because when we do hard things, when you face difficult circumstances, when you say what's difficult, it makes you vulnerable. Maybe that's part of the reason we don't want to do uncomfortable things, because we know it might hurt us. When we get really vulnerable, we leave our comfort zones, we leave what we know, we leave our safety. And there's always a risk that there might be a new scar that would form, that your heart might get broken, that you'll lose a friendship, or that you won't be understood, or that you'll have to face something ugly in yourself. You might get hurt and you might walk with a limp. And that's why we continue then to live into the self-inflicted patterns of catastrophe, because we're afraid that it might hurt, to be honest. Because if we give up our addiction, it means we have to say we have a problem. If we confront our rage, we might have to admit that anger is the emotion that drives everything. If we confront our pursuit of money, or our rights, or our privilege, or our greed, we might have to look in the mirror and actually go, my worth is only defined by what I have, and that's a lie, and my entire life has been built upon one. Because if we're vulnerable enough to face ourselves, to really face ourselves and to wrestle with God about who we really are deep down and who we are created to be, we might limp away from that interaction. We might walk a little hurt after that. Back to the brothers. This is from Genesis 33. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau, coming with his 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and two female servants. He put the female servants and their children in front, Leah and her children next, Rachel and Joseph in the rear. He himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground seven times as he approached his brother. And then verse 4 from Genesis 33. But Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. It's been over 20 years since they've seen each other. And Jacob assumes they're going to have all-out war. And instead, in Esau, we see the move of the father who runs down the road when he sees that his prodigal son has come home. The generosity of a father who loves us and says, all I want is to be in relationship with you. And all I want is for you to find your way back to me. There's this beautiful moment in this conflicted story. Have you ever had one of those moments with your siblings where you expect it's going to be all out war and then you can just embrace and weep because you share these two shared a womb. Oh, there's grace in this story. And then Esau looked up and he saw the women and children. Who are these with you? He asked. Jacob answered, they are the children God has graciously given your servant. And then the female servants and their children approached and bowed down. Next, Leah and all the crazy family system, all the people. He's like, look at all these people. You've got a huge family. Leah and they bowed down. And then Esau goes, what's the meaning of all these flocks and herds that I met? Why did you send all that stuff ahead? And Jacob says, to find favor in your eyes, my Lord. But Esau was like, I've got plenty. Keep what you have for yourself. I just want a relationship with you. No, please. And then Jacob, his old way comes back. Like right away, changes so hard. Like he has this moment of reconciliation with his brother. He has a new name from an angel of God. And then when he has a moment to not do his old stuff, what does he do? He does it. He says, no, please, Jacob, if I found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God now that you have received me favorably. So Esau says, fine, I'll take the gift. The older, a little more healthier brother. Okay, if you really want to give me the gift, I'll take it, right? And then Esau said, well, let us be on our way and we'll go together. But Jacob says to him, my Lord knows that the children are tender and that he must care for the ewes and cows that are nursing their young. If they are driven hard for just one day, all the animals will die. So let my Lord go ahead. So let's separate again. So Jacob actually goes, even though we've just reconciled and you want to like do life together, Jacob actually says, why don't you just go ahead? Now I'll follow up. And then what eventually happens is they kind of settle near each other, but in kind of different ways because it is hard. Like it human, even after Jacob has the mountaintop experience of a new name, reconciling with his brother, he seems to go back to his own ways, which makes me ask the question, like, why does he lie again? Like, does he not trust Esau? Why doesn't he trust Esau? I think because Jacob, even though he is on the pathway to growth, he also knows what's in himself because he wrestled through that night with God. He knows that change is hard, right? It takes the next right step sometimes. And this is one of the bigger hurdles we face as humans when we try to reconcile and lean into broken relationships with other people. It's a defense mechanism, which we call projection. Jacob thinks that Esau is going to treat him the same way that Jacob has treated Esau, harshly and unfairly. Jacob is so focused on himself that he projects his own inner world onto Esau. He assumes that Esau will do the same thing that he would do to him. So it hinders the reconciliation. We often do this. We attribute people's actions to motives that we think they have when they're really just the motives and the things that we have inside of us. And so we assume that the person in our family is going to respond in this way, so we just avoid bringing up the uncomfortable thing, right? Like, we make a conclusion before we even, like, start the story. So when Esau offers to restore the relationship, Jacob's unable to do that, not because of who Esau is, but because of who Jacob is. In the end, he kind of tricks Esau a little bit again because that's what he knows how to do, and he doesn't exactly go to the same place. Because if he were to really just keep walking and completely step into that, he's going to have to do a lot of inner work really fast. He'll have to be vulnerable. He'll have to be courageous because facing your true self feels like risk when your self is wrapped in shame. And yeah, Jacob just can't bring himself to do it, even after it seems that they have reconciled, because he is not reconciled to himself. And this is the source of so many of the broken things in our relationships and why they remain broken, is we often assume the worst about others because we assume the worst of ourselves, right? And so you project, like, you assume everything is going to fall apart, and you assume that so-and-so will also assume that everything's going to fall apart when they may actually not. We think, no one can love me because I don't love me. No one can forgive me because I haven't forgiven myself. And that's how we doom ourselves to these patterns of deceit, these patterns of catastrophe, the sins of our fathers. We become our parents even though we don't want to, right? So to overcome this idol of avoidance and this idol of comfort, I'm not saying we should just go guns blazing into every conflict, right? Because that could be a response too. I avoid conflict, so my path of growth is to just be conflict-oriented. There are better ways to do conflict, right? It's ultimately about being at peace and oneness with your own internal conflict and letting the grace and healing of Jesus speak into that. So we're not, Proverbs has a few things about this. If you want to go to the next slide. Fools find no pleasure in understanding, but delight in airing their own opinions. Right? The lips of fools bring them strife, and their mouths invite a beating. So we're not saying, like, just speak your mind, tell it how it is, right? Because it actually needs to be worked out within yourself first before you can project it onto others. Instead, healthy conflict may look like this in Proverbs 14:9. Fools mock at making amends for sin, but goodwill is found among the upright. Fools mock at making amends for sin, but goodwill is found among the upright. Conflict, wrestling, isn't about inflicting pain and suffering. It's not about getting revenge or making yourself feel better. Healthy conflict is about healing. It's about healing what's broken and making amends. It's about spreading goodwill. And that's probably the most difficult part of conflict, the part about having goodwill. See, goodwill, it's seeking the highest good for another. It's being willing to assume the best of another. To assume the best of another. It's taking a generous interpretation of others' intention. It's being willing to listen first, to listen deeply to what is said, to what is unsaid. It's about asking where the hurt is, where the love is, asking what you may have done wrong. It's the desire to see the other person be whole and healed and put back together. And I would contend that this is the only way out of our cycle of self-destruction, is if we let ourselves be so uncomfortable with our own stuff that we have the courage to find healing and peace within ourselves, so that we own our own stuff and become really vulnerable, that we risk limping, we risk saying sorry. Like, we risk going and saying, hey, yeah, you know that argument we had last night? That's my fault. Because I want to win every argument. Or I wanted to be right. Or I had a selfish desire, right? When you admit that, you might limp away from it. Because you show that you're not perfect, right? You show that you're a human being, right? When you admit, like, oh, I had this selfish desire, how vulnerable is that? Because we're supposed to be strong. We're supposed to be stoic. We're supposed to be tough. But when you admit that you don't have it, so that's what goodwill is. Because we have to wrestle with God, and we have to wrestle with ourselves. We have to wrestle with what it means to be in relationship, right? I always think about relationships. The relationship is the covenant that we give ourselves to. And we each go and do the hard work of receiving love so that we can give love to that relationship first and foremost. I mean, I come from a family where my parents got divorced when I was an adolescent, a teenager. And so I think about, like, what makes relationships fall apart? And more I see it is relationships fall apart when individuals aren't willing to do the personal work themselves of being courageous and vulnerable with their own growth. And then their commitment to the relationship also becomes part of that. So maybe there's a relationship in your life that needs mending. And maybe the idol of comfort and pursuing what's easier has made you avoid voicing that. Maybe even to yourself. Maybe to even write down in a journal, this relationship is not going well. Because when you give voice to something, it starts to take away its power. And maybe just writing it down when you're wrestling with God at night or early in the morning, maybe that will bring it to the light so that you can wrestle with it in the open. So maybe there's a conversation that you've been shying away from, or a decision you've been putting off, or a job you've been realizing, I just need to stop doing this. This is not good for me. And maybe Thanksgiving and the holidays give you anxiety because that means family discomfort. Well, friends, have courage because that makes you a human being. That makes you perfectly normal. We aren't Jacob and Esau, but we also have a lot of stuff that Jacob and Esau had in their family too. And the courage this year may be letting yourself feel what hurts. Why did that one person in the family reject the invitation to my hospitality to host this year? Courage may mean speaking up for what's right, even though it might be uncomfortable. Courage may be having conversations that are not about the weather or sports, right? To actually ask, hey, how are you? Tell me about yourself right now. And it is vulnerable to face the discomfort, to lean into the challenge, to wrestle with it. You might limp away because it might unravel a whole conversation. But you know that feeling? Have you ever had this? Like when you, like, you've been thinking about that thing you're gonna say for like weeks, and then you finally say it, and like in your hands, you experience freedom. Like you just say it, and then you realize, oh, it wasn't that big of a thing. And like it actually repairs the relationship, right? Like just being really honest with each other and like saying, because I love you so much, I'm gonna share this thing that hurt me that you did. Like just voicing that usually makes you experience this freedom. Crazy thing to wrap up here. Do you know how the story of Jacob and Esau ends? Like, it's crazy. So we know the story, we kind of follow Jacob, comes Israel, and then Joseph goes to Egypt and the Exodus, and that's a whole thing, right? It's a whole Bible thing. But think about it in this way, Genesis 35. So Jacob and Esau, they keep on living. They have lots of kids. They settle down. They settle in. Jacob came home to his father, Isaac, in Mamre, near Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had stayed. Isaac lived 180 years. Wasn't Isaac about to die when Jacob stole the birthright? Like, wasn't that the reason Esau went on the hunt? It was like mind blow. Isaac, 180 years, he lived a long, good life, right? Then he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, old and full of years, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. The brothers buried their dad together. If you've buried someone in your family, how important is it that we're all there? That we like forget all the stuff and we experience some sort of conclusion? As people of Jesus, we find hope in that conclusion, in new life and resurrection. But like I was reading this, they buried their dad together. Is that not how we want it to end with our families? Twin brothers who are now old, they may have looked different at birth. One was red and hairy and he drove a Silverado. The other drove a Civic. Now, after all the years and all the stuff, I have to wonder if they look at each other and they look more alike than ever. Their noses and ears have grown the same way and they've got hair grown in the same weird places. And their faces have the look, the look of pain, because pain brings us closer. Suffering adds gray, it adds perspective. Regret can add wrinkles to your eyes. And now in this last moment of grace, in this gift, they get to bury their dad together. Did they talk? If this was a movie, does it end with a hug and then cue the scene? Does it end with a look at each other and then you don't know what happens? We don't know. It's left open. We know about Jacob. We don't know a ton about what happens. There's a few other hard things that happens next. But perhaps I wonder today if this is an invitation to look at our own life and ask the question, how will it end? How will we end well with our families? Will it end with a hug, a cold and distant look? Will we get to bury our dads and our moms and our brothers and uncles and aunts together? Because I think there's a lot of grace in that. And when we're willing to sacrifice the idol of comfort and lean in a little bit to what might be difficult, that thing that we might be avoiding, and we get a little courage, we actually get to find peace and grace at the end. Let's pray. God, we thank you for your love. We thank you that you birth us into families. Families that are full of joy, full of life, families that are full of real stories and real pain and real challenge and real struggle, brothers and sisters and moms and dads and cousins and aunts and uncles. And as we position ourselves to walk into a week to be thankful, we ask that we can receive your good news in our own life and that we can wrestle with you to receive that and embrace in our own selves the places we need to be healed, and that we cannot project what's broken and sinful and hurtful in us onto others, but that we can do the hard work of leaning into your grace and your truth and your healing so that you will give us a new name in Jesus, and that we can participate in giving that new name and the hospitality of your way, the life to the full, to others. And so may we be a people who have courage to talk about what might be uncomfortable. And as we go from this place, I ask that you would bless us with your blessing, and that you would comfort us with your love, and you would give us courage to lean in and to wrestle with the healing that you have for us. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.
Walker Harbor Church, as you go about this week, as you step into gatherings this week, may you have courage. May you be filled with the courage of Christ. May you take the time to reflect, to think, to pray, to surrender the self so that you might live from that place of courage, but also that place of vulnerability and grace in all of your conversations and interactions. And may you, as you step into what we know and what we call as Thanksgiving, may you be overwhelmed, and may your heart be flooded with all kinds of gratitude for every grace and gift and relationship that you have. May that overwhelm you, and may you live from that place then of gratitude. As you go about today and leave here, may you know that the grace and peace of Christ goes with you all. Amen.